Welcome to episode 71 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today I'm talking with Kelsey Pike, a production papermaker based in Kansas City, Missouri. She learned papermaking and started her brand, Sustainable Paper and Craft, while attending the local art institute in 2010. And since then, she's sold over 100,000 sheets of handmade paper. She specializes in papers specifically designed for artists and makers, made from recycled fabric and other sustainable fibers. She's currently searching for a long-term apprentice who will work with her in the studio for the next few years to learn the tedious and backbreaking process. Anyone interested can email Kelsey at sustainablepapercraft.com with the subject line, Apprenticeship. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Kelsey Pike, welcome to Paper Talk. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, let's start out talking a little bit about any childhood artistic or papery influences.
Yeah, of course. Ever since I can remember when I was little, I knew I wanted to be an artist. I didn't know what that entailed exactly. I didn't have any sort of specific paper vision. But if you asked me when I was 6 years old, what I was going to be when I grew up, I would tell you I was going to be an artist. Come high school, obviously I'm planning on going to art school. So I went to the Kansas City Art Institute, and that's when I...
Question about the...
Yeah.
Did you know any artists, or how did you know that could be a career?
That's a good question. Actually, one of my mom's best friends when I was very small was an artist, and we would like go to her, she'd have open houses in her, in her house when we'd see her work. So I guess maybe that's how I knew that you like could be an artist professionally. I don't know.
Okay. And you grew up in Kansas City?
Mm-hmm. Grew up in Kansas City on the Kansas side.
Okay.
Now I live on the Missouri side.
Okay.
What did you say?
Go ahead. So you went to the Kansas City Art Institute.
Yeah. So I went to the Kansas City Art Institute. And when I was there, I took a class called Materials and Methods that was half papermaking and half felting. It was taught by the fibers department. Okay. So that's when I first did papermaking, basically just fell in love with it. And like from that moment forward, like literally like pulling the first sheet, I knew I have to figure out a way to do this for the rest of my life.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
because I taught part of a class at the Oregon College of Art and Craft, very mm-hmm. similar. It was mm-hmm. in the fibers department, and I did papermaking, and mm-hmm. someone else did the other component. So I'm just curious whether you had the same instructor for the whole course or whether it was broken up.
It was the same instructor. It was Tracy Crum.
Oh, yeah.
She studied at Pyramid Atlantic. And we also did like some spinning and rope making and a couple other like little things, but paper making and felting were the two major ones, which was an elective mostly for the fiber students because they didn't like those were not core classes for them, like weaving was.
Your discipline?
I was a printmaking major.
Okay.
Which, we didn't have any paper making in printmaking, but obviously there's some synergy there.
Yeah, right.
But then after that first class was over, I did an independent study. So through my school, you had to like write up a proposal of what you'd study. So I said, let me figure out the ways in which printmaking and papermaking can work together. So I did that first semester. And then after that, I became the studio tech just as a way to continue to be able to use the space. Mm-hmm. So then from there, you know, I'm nearing graduation at that point. the school does not really have a policy where after you graduate, you can use any of the tools or materials. I don't know if that's standard with art schools, but you're kind of just out of luck when you graduate. So I applied.
Business classes, by the way.
Did I take any business classes? The Art Institute has, I forget what they call it, but there's a couple classes that are required that you take along with your major that are about creative business, but more about writing an artist statement, getting into a gallery, like more of that kind of vibe. I know they do a more well-rounded curriculum now about like making and selling products. But back then it was pretty much like, it was assumed that your goal was to be in a gallery.
Right.
So yeah, not a lot of preparation there for, you know, my life. But so anyway, I applied for some grants to buy myself a beater, didn't get those. But by that time I had already started my Etsy shop. I started that my junior year, which I was just making lots of sheets of handmade paper. And I thought, people really like these. Like, people will want to buy these. They'll want to use them for their own artworks. And I was also making some handmade paper sketchbooks, just really simple, like pamphlet stitched sketchbooks. So my first, I don't know, like product launch was, 10 different sketchbooks in a couple different colors. And I sold them for like a ridiculously cheap price that, like, in hindsight didn't make any sense, because it, like, the cost of the paper that was in it was much higher. But anyway, I was new. I didn't know what I was doing. But yeah, so those, it went really well, actually. Like, I don't know if I was just, the timing of when I was on Etsy was right or what, but it went really well. I sold those right away. And then I sort of took the money that I made from that, and I got some money from graduation, and I was able to buy my own beater after that.
Cool. And so how did you market on Etsy? Like, how did you said product launch? So you were obviously thinking about, or now, well, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that was, that was like 10 years ago. Uh-huh. And Etsy was like very much bare bones then. Like, it didn't have any marketing on it. Like, I was on Facebook, but I don't think I used it for business. Mm-hmm. So essentially there was no marketing
then.
Yeah. Yeah.
People just found your products, or did you have a mailing list, or?
No, people just found it. I don't know. That's why I say it was like kind of magic. I don't know like how or why it happened, but okay. It was all sold.
Awesome. Okay.
Yeah.
So you got a beater. What kind of beater?
I got a Mark Lander critter beater. I got the biggest one at the time, which holds 3 pounds of dry fiber. Okay. So then I made a little studio in my parents' garage. Mm-hmm. They live in Lawrence, Kansas, which is by KU. And I worked there, for almost 5 years. But what I would do is, so I had a part-time job working and teaching for continuing education at the Art Institute after I graduated. So I would work there, like Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then I would drive to Lawrence Monday and then like make paper all day, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then drive home and work at the Art Institute. So I was sort of living half and half between the two places. And it was a lot of driving. It was very stressful. Yeah. And I wasn't able to make very much paper because it just wasn't very like time efficient.
Right. What were you doing with the paper you were making? You were still selling it on Etsy.
I was selling it on Etsy. Midway in between there, I started doing some craft fairs, some local ones. At that time, I didn't really have a specific product line of kinds of papers that I was making. I would just like make a batch of like, oh, I'm going to do half hemp and half avoca. And then here's my batch of that. And then I would like bundle them with little bands into like sheets, like 5 packs of sheets. And then I had some pricing like spreadsheets where I would like calculate the prices. And looking back, like none of that was accurate. But yeah, like I would do craft fairs in Lawrence, and people were really receptive to it. Like they loved the paper. A lot of them were like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do with this, but it's beautiful. I need to buy it. And that was just really like encouraging to me. Like that's like, even now, that's not really my experience when I tell people about handmade paper, but it was really encouraging at the time. So I'm like, I'm going to work towards making this my full-time job. Like that was sort of the goal, you know, from the beginning.
Right. And what kinds of classes, what were you teaching continuing ed?
Yeah. For continuing ed, I was teaching a class called, I taught anything that was papermaking, bookbinding, printmaking, embroidery, or like transfer processes. Okay. So I taught a lot of things for them, but they were all mostly for adults. And their the format for continuing education is that's like a 6-week class, 3 hours per week. So I could teach 2 or 3 classes at a time and still have plenty of time to do, you know, all my other things. And I actually continued to teach for them until just 3 months ago when they laid off the entire continuing education department because of COVID. Wow. So I'm now officially, as of October, full-time sustainable paper craft paper maker.
Awesome.
Yeah.
When did you name your company?
It was when I was still in school. It was when I first opened it. So
sustainable paper craft. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. So you said about 5 years you were working out of your parents' garage,
mm-hmm.
doing these craft fairs and selling on Etsy as well.
Yes. Yep.
And didn't really have a product line.
We're just kind
of testing the waters. Okay. And then what happened?
Let's see. That's when I started to think, you know, I was getting more orders and people were trying to place like custom orders for like larger amounts of paper. And that's when my capacity started to be a problem, like how much paper I could make with driving to Lawrence all the time, like wasn't keeping up with how much paper people wanted to buy from me. So I started thinking I really need to find a studio space in Kansas City, closer to my house, so I can work there more. So the neighborhood that my husband and I lived in, there was like a main street sort of area, but all of the buildings were pretty much abandoned, but they were being like renovated. So anyway, I saw an article in the newspaper about these two guys who were renovating this building, and their brand name is Maker Village, and they're going to, it was like at the time. Okay. So I saw an article in the paper about how these two guys were going to turn this abandoned building into a woodworking and metalworking like community shop. Mm-hmm. So I kind of thought that's really cool. That sort of like makes sense with what I do. So I contacted them to see if they would have any extra space for me to have a studio there. And they said, well, actually we're just like, this building has like two halves. We're just going to use half of it for our thing. And we had envisioned like the other half being an artist studio space. So that's perfect. That's exactly what we want. But they didn't want to get into the business of like selling little parcels of it to different artists. They wanted one person to take over the rent for the whole thing and to manage that. So anyway, that's where the Cherry Pit Collective was born.
It was too big for just you to run.
Too big for just me, especially at that point.
Is that
whole about 1500 square feet?
Okay.
So at that point they were still about a year out from it being like ready. So at that point I started working out a plan of seeing like, is it feasible? Like how many studios would it be? How much would it cost? Are people interested in this? And started like going around and pitching this to people. And I was working with my close friend at the time, Adri Luna, to sort of figure out all of these things. But anyway, a year down the line, we have a bunch of people sort of like signed up to move into the studio space. So then we ran a Kickstarter to raise funds for the final build out and install that included like the HVAC system and big dollar stuff like that. But yeah, we opened in October 2016. Since then, we sort of changed. So all of the members since the beginning were always female identifying and women artists. But kind of a year after that launch, we sort of, you know, concreted the fact that like this is an all women's studio space. It just worked really well like that. Everyone was very comfortable there, and it was just a really like inviting and warm space for everybody. So we decided to just keep it that way.
So what does where's the name Cherry Pit Collective come mm-hmm. from, and what is the sort of business arrangement for the collective?
Right. So it's called Cherry Pit Collective because it's on Cherry Street. Okay. And there was like a joke because all of those businesses were sort of boarded up, but there were all of these like DIY people sort of like working on them. It was like a joke that it was like the Cherry Pit, like the armpit, like of the neighborhood. But then also Cherry Pit is like, it's the seed. So it's sort of like the start of the growth and whatever. Cause we were one of the first things that were open on that street. Whereas now 4 years later, it's a hair salon, a coffee shop, you know, it's, you know,
you set the trend.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, fully thriving sort of business area now. And the business model, I mean, to get into the nitty gritty, like I just run the Cherry Pit as a DBA under my own LLC. And then the deal is, you know, people want to rent a studio space. I say, okay, this is how much space, this is how much it'll be a month. And then in addition to the dollar amount, they also have to agree to do chores or tasks. So they have to help clean or help do things that we do for the community. Like, I don't know, like work on our Spotify playlist or like organize a meeting, or I don't know, sometimes we do like craft fair booths as a group. So they would like organize that. So those sorts of things.
And how is the physical space divided up?
Yeah, it's, so it's 1500 square feet and it's all basically one room. And then there's a basement. In the back half is sort of a communal space. So there's two really big tables and a TV, and we have like classes and events there. And then around there is like kitchen cabinets and the sink, and we have a washer dryer. So it's sort of like break room vibes. But also the big tables are really useful if you just need to like spread out and work on a really big table. Uh-huh. And then in the front, they're basically stalls on either side of the walls. So nothing is like closed with doors or anything. Like all of the studios open up into like the main middle space, which is really great because you always know like who's there, and you can always, you know, you always wave at them and chat and say hello. Like it's impossible to really be by yourself while you're there, which I think is one of the nice things.
And how many stalls are there then, or studios?
There are 6 physical stalls plus the basement. But some of the stalls are shared, like half and half between 2 people. And then we also have a deal called the squad membership, where if you, it's more like co-working. Like if you just need to use like our big tables, or we have like a little lounge couchy area, if you just want to use that to meet with clients, you can have a key and do that for like a lower price point. Uh-huh. And then they also get to participate when we do projects or events, or they get to take our classes for free and stuff.
Right. And is this like a storefront setup too?
It's not. We could have a storefront, and actually in the past we have had a storefront like around the holidays. It just depends on like who's there, like who's a part of the collective and like what they want to do. But actually we didn't do it this year because of COVID, but the previous 2 years, there's like a little, right across the street from our space, there's a little tiny storefront that it like rotates a lot what's in there, but it was empty the last 2 holiday seasons. So we rented it because we know the guy that owns that building, and we organized a little store over there to sell all of our things.
Uh-huh. Oh, cool.
So, yeah.
And so it sounds like you have some turnover.
We do, yeah. At this point, there's maybe 3 of us that have been there since the beginning. So that's 4 years. But other than that, most people stay for a year to 2 years. Being as that it's all young women, essentially, like, if they're getting ready to start a family, they might move out. Maybe they were in an apartment before, but now they're in a house and they have more space. They're going to work at home. Or maybe they had some sort of side hustle, but then they got a promotion at work. So now they're going to focus on that. So lots of like life changes are sort of the reasons why people leave us.
Right. And you're in the middle of the country. I'm just curious what the rent range is from.
Yeah. So we're about $4 a square foot. And that includes utilities. Uh-huh. But yeah, rent is pretty affordable here compared to other places. Like we get 1500 square feet for about $1,600 a month.
Uh-huh. And so tell me about your space in there. And yeah. Also, I want to hear a little bit about your equipment. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Lander Beater, and I think you name your equipment too.
I do. Yeah. Okay. So my studio is sort of in the back of the Cherry Pit. It's about, I'm trying to think how big it is. It's like 8 by 16 feet.
Okay.
Maybe 10 by 16. But we have, one of the newest things that I put in is this floor tray. So the entire studio, I've covered the floor in black plastic HEDPE sheeting. And then it has like a lip around the edge. So the whole thing is a waterproof tray, essentially.
Yeah.
And then I have my formation table, mm-hmm. which it has gutters. So all of the water from that drains into a bucket and then it pumps into the sink because there's no floor drain in my studio. And when I was first looking at studio spaces, I was sort of thinking, oh, well, that's, you know, that's a deal breaker. I have to have a floor drain because that's just what we had in school. But there's definitely ways to like work around that. So all of the water either drains into this bucket and goes into the sink, or if I spill anything, it's sort of in the tray of my floor, and then we just dry it with floor fans.
Tell me a little bit more about that HDPE tray. So did you have that custom built? Because I know a company in Oregon, Oblation mm-hmm. Press, actually had a special floor built. Figure that out.
No, I just figured it out. So ever since I've had my studio in my parents' garage, my dad has sort of been my partner in like helping me build all of these things because he's a very handy man. So yeah, the flooring that is in the studio like already is like a subfloor, and the landlords had sort of said, oh, well, we don't really care if you trash it. Like eventually we're going to put a better floor there. So whatever you want. But you know, over the past 4 years, it's gotten really wet. And now like when I walk on it, there's like squishy parts and it wasn't great. So
situation. So that's kind of why I'm asking too.
I
have different things and the landlord doesn't care. And same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was like, can we please just pour a concrete floor? And they're like, oh, I don't know. So anyway, I just took care of myself. But I was trying to ask my dad, oh, should we get like a big roll of vinyl flooring and put that down? And he's like, well, I think what actually be better is this HEDPE plastic, which is, it comes in like 4x8 sheets like plywood. And I don't know what they actually use it for, but it's really smooth on one side and it has a texture on another side. So then we built the tray with, it has 3/4 plywood under to provide some cushion and to just, because the floor was so uneven, it sort of like evens out the span of it. And then the plastic on top. And we staggered the seams of the plywood and the plastic.
Right.
And then in between it has waterproof caulking. And then around the edge, we have like, it's like this black plastic, I think it's for fencing or something, but it's like 2 inches tall and it kind of makes just a whole tray. So I don't know, we just built it and it's working really well.
Is it in your whole space or just part mm-hmm. of
it? Well, it covers the whole formation area, which is pretty much the whole studio. The other area that I use is actually the larger of the two restrooms. And that's my beater room. Okay. So I actually have two Lander beaters now. So my first one, the biggest one I told you that I bought, her name is Hollis, because she's a Hollander beater. And then a few years ago, this woman contacted me to say that her sister, who was moving into a retirement home, like had all this papermaking equipment, would I want to buy it? And I said, absolutely. And then she shows up with this Hollander beater. And I was like, yeah, I want all this $200 for all of her books, all of her molds, all of it. So anyway, then I'm looking through all of these papers and I see that the name of the woman who owned it was Bert. And then I look back and Bert is one of the first women who came to one of my first craft fairs. And she came right up to me and said, oh, you're a paper maker. I saw that you were going to be here. I came to seek you out because I'm also a paper maker. So anyway, that I just thought was very special. So her name is Bert now in her honor.
And that's a Lander beater too?
Mm-hmm, yeah, it's the smallest of the Lander beaters. I think it's supposed to hold a pound.
Yeah, what else do you have? What kind of press?
Mm-hmm. I have a 10-ton hydraulic press that my dad and I built.
Okay.
It's nothing fancy. It doesn't have a gauge or anything, but it has gutters on both sides too that drain all the water into a single bucket. I have a little fridge to keep my chemicals in.
For vats. Sorry.
Yeah. My vat is, I think it holds about 50 gallons and it's for hydroponic gardening. It's just like a big,
you just use that one vat primarily?
Yep. I just use the one vat. Uh-huh. We put a drain on it.
Kelsey has great videos and visuals on her website and all about the process. So we'll put the link to your website in the show notes and people should take a look. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very small and efficient studio, I think, compared to other studios because I sort of only make like one kind of paper. Like I'm doing the same kind of thing all the time. So it's set up just perfectly for what I'm doing. Whereas like other studios that do more artistic work always need to like sort of rearrange and reform things. But yeah, my vat fits all of my molds. I find it most useful to use the biggest vat possible because it keeps your water to pulp ratio the most consistent for sheet thickness over time. So yeah.
Okay, and what kind of molds and decals do you have?
Yeah, well, my dad and I made them. Okay. I have my largest size is 16 by 20, uh-huh. 11 by 14, 8 by 10, 5 by 7 are sort of my standard sheet sizes. I also made some envelope shaped molds and decals. And it's not just the decal that's envelope shape, it's the whole mold. Is like the shape of an envelope open. And I made those on the CNC mill at the Art Institute when I had access there. I'd have those in A2, A6, and A9, and also the flat sheets in division molds to go with.
Okay.
And then business cards and a couple square sizes.
How do you store those? Just curious.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that my storage situation is not ideal, but I have a like white metal IKEA shelf that has perforated shelves.
Uh-huh.
And I just stack them and store them flat.
Okay.
So when I'm done using them, I set them like upright by a fan and let them drip. And then when they're like pretty much dry, I stack them and put them away. That seems to keep most warping at bay.
Right. And what about the screen surface?
Yeah, it's the heat shrink mesh from Carriage House. And then we tack it in with stainless steel tacks and then epoxy over the edges so they're nice and smooth.
Okay. And so tacks rather than staples?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Okay. So on one of your videos, I saw, this is another piece of equipment or a tool, a counting mm-hmm. device.
Yeah.
Because when you make sheets of paper, I have this. You're really doing it. You know, you need to make a certain number because you're doing production. I'm like counting all the time. How many felts do I have? But you have this cool. What is it?
Like an
abacus or something?
Yeah, it's an abacus. I took this like intro to like I don't know, the Fab Lab, which is like 3D printers, CNC routers, whatever. So yeah, we got to do a project on the 3D printer. I'm like, you know, what'd be really helpful is a little thing where I can count to 10, because when I make paper, essentially I do towels, 5 sheets of paper with Pellons in between, then another towel, 5 more sheets, towel. And then I pull that off and put it in the press because I find that I don't get enough pressure, you know, mid post if I have a larger post than 10 sheets or so. And then the towel in the middle, I separate it there and then I hang dry them. So it's 5 sheets hanging to dry at a time, if that makes sense. So anyway, that abacus lets me say, you know, 1 sheet, you know, switch, 2 sheet switch, instead of, cause I was before, yeah, like always like counting, like, oh, how many is here? And it's, you know, not efficient. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, I love efficiency.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying you're like spur drying in spurs.
Yes.
The 5 pellons with sheets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you always making sheet couching, one sheet on top of another, or do you have layers? Well, you said you have the molds with multiple business cards or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you're, whatever size you're making, is it all based on your press size or?
It is. Yeah. My press is not very large. Like the whole, like 16 by 20 sheet is the biggest that can really fit in it with some pellon around it. Okay. So yeah, if I'm doing 11 by 14, it's just one per pellon. Mm-hmm. But if I'm doing the 5 by 7, the mold is like a division for 4. So it's 4. I know, I watch videos sometimes of people doing like laying 2 8 by 10s and I'm like, I should do that, but I don't, I just do one.
Yeah. Well, you kind of get set in your ways.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to tell you about The Paper Year, which is going online this year in 2021. This is an annual subscription club, kind of like a year-long online class, featuring a new paper project every month. Get inspired with video and written project instructions designed to spark ideas that keep you creating for the rest of the month. Explore creative paper techniques, including origami, pop-ups, paper weaving, book arts, paper cutting, and more. And join our growing community of paper lovers online to learn and share in a warm, encouraging, supportive, creative community. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com to find out more and hold your spot. Registration opens again in early April of 2021.
So then you're drying these just on lines with clothespins?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how long do you make sheets?
About overnight or maybe 2 days. Uh-huh. It depends a lot on if the AC or heating is on. I mean, one of the things that I do that I think I should probably mention that's, I think, is unique with papermakers is that I always use 2 molds, 1 deckel as I'm forming sheets, which I think, again, really increases efficiency. So
if it's an old technique.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Yeah, I read about it in The Dart Hunter, and then I'm like, I got to try that. And then, of course, the Chancery Papermaking by Tim Barrett. Yeah. It's all about that. But yeah, so I pull 1 sheet, and then I set it down to dry, to drain, and then I'm covering the sheet from before with the pellon, and then I switch the 2 molds, pull the deckel off, you know, couch it, and then I'm pulling the next sheet. Again, I have lots of videos of that, but it's very efficient.
So you're putting the pellon on top of the mold before you couch?
No, on top of like the previous paper that's like
post. Okay.
Yeah. On the post. Yeah.
Because making paper is, you get into a rhythm. So you've figured out a great technique. Cool.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how you, what kind of papers you're making, the sustainability part of that, mm-hmm. and just a little bit about your production, like your week or.
Yeah.
It seems like you have a real flow going.
I do. Yeah, so now I'm basically making 2 sort of major product lines. I have the classic cotton paper, which is a mix of rag and like fabric that I process and linters. And I make that in 5 standard colors. And then I have the mixed media paper, which is a cotton abaca blend, and I make that in 10 colors. And then I attempt to keep all of those in stock on my Etsy shop in the 3 major sizes, 5 by 7, 8 by 10, 11 by 14. That's sort of the goal. Now the holidays.
How many is that you're trying to keep like on your shelf?
Oh, like 10 or 20 of each.
Okay.
Yeah. Like not a ton. But the holidays always hit so hard, and then I'm trying to like restock like everything, is gone.
Yeah. And I saw you had like a deadline for orders. So you really, you have created demand for yourself.
Yes.
Do you get repeat orders? So you're getting orders from shops and things, or is mm-hmm. it new orders?
It's a big variety. So on Etsy, you know, anyone can type in handmade paper and find me and buy a couple sheets, you know. They might turn into repeat customers and come back and buy paper forever from me, or maybe that was just a one sale. But then in addition to the Etsy stock, I have lots of clients that I work with one-on-one on a regular basis. I'm trying to think of some examples.
Letterpress printers or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, there's a letterpress printer that I work with. So she's always getting the cotton and the thick and the A2, and she wants a couple thousand a month. And then there's somebody who prints little posters for her own Etsy shop on the 5x7 mixed media paper. She gets a couple thousand a month. There's this brand that makes really cute, like baby quilts, and they send me their fabric scraps, which I recycle into paper. And then they use that paper to wrap the quilts when they send them. So that's a pretty regular gig for me. Yeah, right now those are maybe the you know, like always I can count on these orders. But then maybe my bread and butter is printmakers, and not even like letterpress printers, but like block printers. And I think that that's because when I very first started making paper, I was in school as a printmaker, and that's sort of what I designed the paper to do best, the cotton paper especially. So lots of linoleum block artists will come at me wanting, you know, a couple hundred sheets in a certain size and color for a special edition that they're doing or something.
Oh, okay. And so let's talk about the contents of your paper a little more. Mm-hmm. So I know you have the confetti and you mentioned quilt scraps. Mm-hmm. And I mean, your company is called Sustainable Paper Craft.
Yeah.
You sent me some samples and they came in a Eco Enclosed, which is a very responsible company, mm-hmm. packaging company. And this tape was on it that I've seen advertised online that's sustainable. So, and I know you put some things in your paper as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Man, the sustainability road. Like when I first picked that name was sort of when sustainability, like in 2010, when it was like a new thing. It's like, oh, what does this mean? And I was just like, this paper is tree free. So it's sustainable, whatever. But I've learned so much since then and it's evolved. But I try to use as much as I can, like fabric scraps. So the content of like my basic cotton paper is about half, like fabric scraps that I get from local quilters.
Okay.
The confetti paper, which you mentioned, which is sort of, I've made it for a while, but I've just added it to my standard stock papers as one that I'll like always make. It has, fabric scraps, but in all of the colors. So it's, you know, sort of looks like confetti. But it was actually kind of hard to figure out how to make that paper look the same batch after batch. Yeah. So because of the color, you know, how much pink and how much purple is in there. I finally like sat down and like with all my fabric scraps, which have been pre-washed and shredded and sort of measured out, okay, here's a gallon baggie and it's going to get 2 ounces of purple, whatever. So now I have like 12 of those. So whenever I'm ready to make that, that goes in the beater. So hopefully it should be the same for the next 5 years, you know.
You mentioned shredding. How are you doing that?
Yeah. Oh, with a rotary cutter by hand.
Okay. Yeah.
It's not great.
Fabric has to be cut small to go through the beater.
In the beater. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I know one of the things that you had asked about is, do I do all of the work myself or do I hire, you know, helpers for things? And the answer to that is that all of the sheet formation, I always do myself, but tasks like shredding the fabric, I absolutely like hire people to help me with. Uh-huh. I also have assistants, Coco, who has been my assistant for many years. She'll do things like she'll sort the paper for me. Like I have, a process after the paper is dry where it gets weighed and it gets cited and it gets picked. And I trust her to do that process for me. But then I also have people who help me during the holidays, like package orders, all the things, or like answer Etsy messages, like all the things that are like peripheral to like actually making the paper. I hire people to help when I need.
Okay. And is Coco full-time or?
No. Nope, she's part-time and sort of contract-based. So just like when the need is there, she helps out in her free time. So yeah, I don't have any like employees.
Okay. And then tell me you said weighed, sided, and picked. So weighed, yeah. I get, that's for the thickness.
Mm-hmm.
Sided is just looking at it to make sure.
Siding is like, yeah, like looking at it with light through it.
Okay.
Looking for watermarks or, you know, creeping or anything. And then picking is like, we go with tweezers and pick off any dirt or fibers or hairs or anything like from the surface on both sides.
Okay, cool. And so what's your, like, how many sheets of paper are you making a week? Are you doing it every day? You have a schedule?
Yeah. Yeah. So I make paper 3 days a week. So it's Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. I go to studio at 2 and I spend like the first hour, like pulling down the paper that's dry, from the day before. Then I form sheets until about 11 PM. And then I spend the last hour pressing and cleaning. So I do that 3 days a week. And depending on the size, I can make like, I don't know, 1,000 sheets a week. I don't know. I count them all the time. Yeah. And I just was looking at my 2020 numbers and I made like 31,000 sheets last year. So I don't know if anyone wants to do that math, but
wow. Are you a night person or are you trying to get work with your husband's schedule or what?
Yeah. I mean, both of those things. Yeah. My husband works in a restaurant. So he works second shift. So he works from 2 to midnight. Okay. So I just mirror that. I'm also just like a night person. Like 8 PM is like my favorite time to like be doing stuff. So yeah, I love to work late, but also it's been very convenient in the studio when we're trying to like work around COVID because we only want to have you know, one or two people in the studio at a time. So yeah, if I work that later shift, it, you know, I'm not hogging the whole studio all day for everyone else who wants to work during the day.
Yeah, cool. And so, what is your, just tell me a little bit about your marketing. I mean, we've kind of talked about it, but it seems like things just come to you. I mean, you have a very, you put things on Instagram and everybody's like liking it and saying, yeah, I'm in. So I know you're doing that. Are you doing other things?
Yeah. Marketing is so weird because like, I feel like I don't really know anything about it and yet I'm doing it all the time and it seems to be working. But I feel like from the very beginning, I was never really worried about marketing. I was always just worried about making like the best possible paper that would make people want to come back and buy more paper. Right. So sort of from there, I'm like, oh, you know, 2 years in, I need a logo, you know, a year after that, I should probably pick a font and use that all the time, whatever. And it's just sort of evolved from there. It's just gone uphill.
Brand and
you, yeah,
as you said, when you were first selling papers at craft fairs, people wanted to buy it probably because they like you. That's probably,
yeah, probably, you know? Yeah, yeah,
and then the product, and you have a high quality product,
yeah. Yeah, so I think I'm lucky in that people buy the paper, they love it, they tell people about it. But yeah, I've also been pretty successful on Instagram and using that for marketing. And I think the thing that sets me apart there is that, I mean, I take beautiful photos. Like people love to just see like a beautiful photo. And then I also am always showing like the behind the scenes process, like, because to me it's important that they see and that they know, like, I am making this paper with my hands. Like there are a lot of, especially on Instagram, of accounts that are just every day, like, here's a beautiful picture of some letterpressed wedding stationery, But then you dig further and, oh, that paper is made in India. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but like, it's not made by that person. So to me, that's an important part of my brand, that I'm also sharing information about paper making for other people, because I want them to know that I am an expert in paper making, you know, like I know what I'm doing, like,
right.
Anyway.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. Now I know you make these really sweet hand carved rubber stamps. Yes. Tell me about that and how that got started.
Yeah. I'm a printmaking major from school. So obviously we did linoleum block carving back then. And then a couple years after that, you know, when you're fresh out of school and you don't really have very much money. So I made all of my family for Christmas presents, like little stamps with their names to put in their books. And my mom just wouldn't stop about how cute those were and about how I needed to sell those. And I was like, oh, well, it doesn't really go with the paper, you know, whatever. But then finally I was like, yeah, I'll put these in the shop, whatever. And yeah, people love them. Yeah. So now I have a couple standard designs of library stamps like that. And I do like initial stamps, monograms, whatever. And essentially it's like for the library stamps, I put their name around the outside and they can choose one of 50 images that I've like pre-drawn for the middle. So those are sort of like the standard ones, but then I also do lots of logo stamps for people, which is like they provide me with their logo and then I carve it different sizes, shapes, to put on their branding stuff. And those people are more so than the paper one-off customers. Like they'll just find me on Etsy, buy a stamp. Some people will come back for another one when they start a new business or something, or when they move, they need a new address stamp, but it's not like they're just buying stamps over and over again for the most part.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah. I'm thinking I need to get one or more because I have these little labels I stick on as a return address. It'd be so much cooler to have one of your
stamps. Have a little stamp. Yeah. I love stamps also for like packaging your products because I don't know, like if the alternative is like handwriting something on there, like a stamp looks a lot more professional, but you don't have to like pay to have it printed, right. You know?
Yeah. Do you, so obviously you're sourcing out the handles.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're,
together or are you, tell me a little bit.
How are they made? So the wood blocks that they're on, is like reclaimed wood. Again, my dad, who is awesome, he volunteers at the Habitat for Humanity Restore and they'll get donations of like weird bits of wood. So he'll, you know, the ones that are weird shapes that nobody wants, he'll take them and then cut them into like little, like 1-inch squares. Oh. And then I sand them and finish them. And then those are the stamp handles. And yeah, so I carve the stamp and I use like a soft pink rubber from Speedball. Mm-hmm. And then I stamp it on top of the stamp and then I glue it on the bottom. And it's good to go. Little stamp.
Okay. So it's just a block.
Yeah, it's just a block. It's not a fancy handle or anything.
Cool. That's awesome. And then the papers you're selling, we've mm-hmm. talked about that, but do you have like a interesting order that you've gotten? Yeah. I think you do some custom orders and you.
I do. Some of my favorite work is when people come to me and say, I have a vision. I want to do a print series. I need this really dark blue paper and I want it, you know, whatever. Like I love that kind of work. But one of the most special projects that I worked on this year, I think, was some people that I know started a new clothing brand where they use naturally dyed fabrics to make sustainable like linen and cotton clothing that you would, you know, wear forever. So they saved their fabric scraps for me for a few months. And then I made paper out of it. And then I also made them a little logo stamp. And then they use those for the care and handling tags to hang on to the clothing, which I thought was just really special.
So you made them actually to size so that it has mm-hmm. the decals?
Yeah, so it has the crazy decal edges with the fabric hanging all over it. Yeah.
Right. How cool. And I want to mention that this is January of 2021. This episode will come out in a couple of months, but I'm putting together every quarter this year a curated paper collection to sort of feature different makers and different paper stores. So I'll have about a dozen different papers in these quarterly curated paper collections. And one of Kelsey's sheets is going to be in my first one, which will be available in February. I'm not sure if I'll still have any by the time this podcast is out, but maybe. And So I just love to support paper artists and to introduce my students and followers to the potential of paper and where paper's being made and where they can get unique papers. So I'm excited about that. So on that note, you have really cool names for your papers, and you're always giving a little piece of history when you name. I just saw you had your Terra Verde on an Instagram post, and you talked about where that name came from. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So when I was looking to name the colors of the mixed media papers, I kept coming back to the fact that the mixed media paper is for artists. It's made for drawing and painting. So I said the colors should... Well, I started by looking at other like art papers. I'm like, what are they naming these? Because, you know, I have a white in the cotton, but I didn't want to name it white again, like, because I don't want to have, you know, that seems very confusing. So anyway, I said they should all be named after art materials. So the blue was a celadon after, you know, the ceramic glaze. The brown that you have for your box is called Bistair, which is the name of one of the like classic Conte crayons. The Terra Verde is a green pigment that comes from, you know, the earth in some specific place in Italy. And it's like this beautiful green color, and they used it to make oil paints. And I just think that's it's sort of like takes home the fact that like this paper is for artists. Like if you don't understand what these words are, like maybe it's not for you, because these are art words. Right. And then two, like, nobody else who didn't like do that research or whatever is going to name their paper, their green paper, Terra Verde. So that makes mine special. Like how many moss green papers are there in the world, you know, but mine's different.
Yeah. Well, cool. Okay. And you had a couple of things to recommend. So yes. Let's talk about those. So first is a book, The Ikata Witch.
Yes. So this year, in 2020, I guess, I went through, I've always loved sci-fi and fantasy shows and books, but this year I made like an intention to really read a lot and to also read a lot of work by Black authors. So this book, Ikata Witch, is by Nnedi Okorafor, and it's about a teenage girl who is raised in America, but then she moves back to Africa with her parents, finds out that she has inherited this magic from her grandma, and then she becomes like involved in this sort of secret society of witches and wizards, and has this cohort of like teen, you know, other teens that are sort of, you know, learning their craft. And it's a very sweet book, and I feel like you will love it. But the thing that I think is relevant to paper is that she has this pet that is a magic paper wasp. And every night as she sleeps, the wasp sort of gathers materials from around the house and makes little sculptures that will like amuse and delight her. And it's usually like about something that they saw the previous day or something. And then when she wakes up and sees it, the wasp is just very happy about it and like flies around and then, you know, starts again the next day. And I just think it's very charming.
Oh, that is charming. Cool. All right. And you also had the Tim Barrett's book, European Hand Paper Making.
Yeah. Reading that was sort of a turning point in my understanding of, I don't know, like the science behind paper making. Like I read it right when it came out, and I was already sort of on the cusp of being like, I want to be sure that I'm doing things very right here. And that just, I don't know, it was mind blowing at the time. I was taking notes about all the things that I needed to test and check and look at, but also just the humor of that book, like made it so engaging and fun to read. So highly recommend.
Yeah. And what's one thing that you incorporated into your papermaking practice from that book?
Well, he talks at length about the way to dip specifically, uh-huh. about how the back edge of your mold should never really go under the water, and the way he's describing it. And then I went and watched some videos that he recommended. I was coming in sort of at more a shallow angle and going all the way under and pulling up, which is not how they would do it traditionally, because it's just more energy and it's, you know, harder on your back and all of this. So yeah, now I come in at more steep of an angle. The back never goes in, and then it's more of a flipping sort of motion.
I love that. I do that as well. And I don't even remember where I learned that. I mean, when I was first making paper, people were talking about the ergonomics and starting having problems. I think the studio where I learned, they did dip all the way under, like you were describing. So
yeah,
it's so interesting.
And it's so heavy when you dip all the way under.
Yeah. And then the North American Hand Papermaking Conferences. When did you go to your first one? And let's talk a little bit about that organization.
Are you? Yeah. I'm not.
No, you're not. Okay.
So the first conference I went to was in Santa Fe, which was 4 years ago.
Yeah, I think 2007.
Yeah, so I just love going to the conferences. This year it was online, but usually they're like at a place, and it's like the highlight of my year to travel to this place, attend all these conferences, like listen to these talks about oddly specific paper research that people have done, and then just to meet all these people who I've read about, or I've seen them on Instagram or whatever. And it's also just such like a welcoming environment. I don't know, like I'm not the kind of person who would go to a networking thing and want to shake people's hands and like introduce myself. Like I'm just more behind the scenes than that. But I have heard from people who were like, oh, well, I didn't go to the North American Hand Paper Makers conference because I don't know, I don't really do conferences. But like, if you're a paper maker, you got to get there because it's your people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really friendly community, and it's a lot of fun. And it's every year in a different city. So they're all, there's a conference committee that organizes tours of different places in that city, or workshops at the school that has paper making. And
yeah,
I've gone for years. It's great. It's great. Do you have anything coming up that you want to tell us about, or?
I mean, a new thing that I'm doing is brand new. I just announced it like yesterday. Is I'm calling it a monthly paper parcel, and it's a subscription box that'll come out every month. And I mean, I think you'll appreciate the behind the scenes like rationale for this is that I get a lot of orders for white paper. People just want thousands and thousands of sheets of matching white paper. And I love that. I love to make you white paper, but I can also do really interesting things. So every month, the sort of like color scheme and theme of the box will be different, and it'll be an outlet for me to create more interesting colors, textures. I can do double-sided sheets. I can do gradient pulls, like all that cool stuff that I haven't really done since school, because nobody really knows that you can do it with paper. So they don't know to order it, you know? So I'll get to play with that. It'll be fun for me, but then also hopefully people will see those really cool papers in there and be like, wow, I really want to do a print edition on this paper that transitions from white to black, or, you know, whatever. So I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so you subscribe and you pay by the month?
Is that Yeah, so people are paying now for a box that's going to ship February 1st, but essentially if they pay any time within the month, they'll get sort of the next one, and then they're subscribed until they turn it off, and then they'll just get 10 sheets of paper. They get to choose the size if they want the bigger sheets or the smaller sheets.
Right.
And it'll be fun, interesting new stuff every month.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, and where can listeners find you online? We'll post these in the show notes too.
But yeah. Well, you can look at my website, which is sustainablepapercraft.com. You can find me on Etsy. My shop name is Kelsey Pike. You can also find me on Instagram. My handle is Kelsey Pike Papercraft.
Great. Well, it's been really fun talking to you and learning about your business, Kelsey. Thanks for
coming. Yeah, thank you so much. It's been really a pleasure to speak with you, Helen. You're one of my idols.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon. The reason, besides the season.